National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History, number 2. My name is Marvin Herzog, and my respondent's name is Mitchell Bork. Today is Tuesday, May the 18th, 1999. Dr. Bork, you use the word assimilated several times in your description.
Correct.
Of your times in Europe. What is meant by assimilated?
Well, I don't know exactly according to Webster's dictionary what it's meant. But it's meant that it's trying, that an individual is trying to assimilate, to become part of the overall society of the particular country or whatever. So Jews tried, those who were assimilated or were assimilating, tried to become part of the Polish society. That didn't mean that they would go to church or observe necessarily Catholic holidays, but by the same time they didn't wear pious, or they were not Orthodox, they were just assimilated. They wore the same kind of clothes as the Poles were, tried to serve in the army, not necessarily reaching high ranks, but those with high school graduation certificates were officer candidates. Not necessarily became officers, but at least they wore insignia indicating that they had diplomas, high school diplomas.
We're told that in Europe people had to have identification papers.
Yes, that's true.
And that the race or religion of that person was sometimes marked on them.
Not sometimes, it was always marked.
Now these assimilated Jewish people were marked, were identified as Jews?
Well, in Poland you had two identifications. You had nationality and you had religion. And the assimilated Jews, they could fill out whatever they wanted. It's not that they were marked, you know, not like in Hitler's time, that they were marked with a J for Jude. But they would have in those ID papers, they would have nationality, Polish, and religion, Hebraic or Mosaic, whatever. It was not Jewish religion. It was not stated Jewish. It was stated, I would say, the equivalent of Hebraic or according to Moses' law, this kind of thing. Yeah.
We in the United States have been told...
By the way, if I may interrupt, you know that in here there was the same thing. I remember filling out forms for the University of Illinois in 1940, 47, 48, 49, where there was church affiliation. Oh, you didn't know that? Oh, yes. And then it was discontinued. And in that case, I filled out, I remember, none. But it was, yes. Then there was a business of race. There was a place for race. And they discontinued that too. They fought about discontinuing it and the explanation of the government, I'm talking the United States, was that they wanted to keep track how many different races, you know, for statistical purposes. So that was the explanation. Now you don't have it. I don't think that they have it. Or you
we
don't have
United
to
States
for that.
Have been told that the Polish people were generally anti-Semitic. Yet you earlier indicated that you experienced very little, if any, anti-Semitism.
All right. I think that in the States, in the Jewish community, there is a misconception about Polish anti-Semitism. Sure, they were anti-Semites, and this was fanned by the church. Anti-Semitism was fanned by the church, Catholic Church. But you see, many of the Jews in the United States who came from Europe came from the Tory territories which were under the Russian thumb, the Ukraine, the Belarus, and so there was mainly, I would say, Russian anti-Semitism, which exists to this day, let's face it. And in Poland, the Jews were since, well, first of all, I don't know if I mentioned it in the previous interview, but when the Jews came to Poland after the Inquisition and so on, they became subjects of the king. In other words, for killing a Jew, that doesn't mean that they lived mixed with Polish population, but for killing a Jew, the person was killed. They were protected by the king. They had their own courts, religious courts and so on. It was a separate community. They referred to it as a state within a state. And some of the Polish anti-Semitism grew out of the fact that the Jews were a separate community. They didn't mix, they didn't try to mix, they didn't try to speak the language. They spoke either Hebrew or mainly Yiddish, which was German, which was like salt on the wounds, you know. They were protected by the king. And then when the constitution on May 3rd, I think 1791, if my memory doesn't fail me, granted equal rights to all the citizens, even to minorities. And there was, at that time, in 1794, there was an uprising against the Russians, because the Russians already, Poland wasn't partitioned as yet, but they were very strong and dominant in Poland, especially in the central part. Warsaw, those areas. And there was an uprising led by Kościuszko, who participated in the Revolutionary War here. He went back and started an uprising. And the Jews were defending Warsaw from the Russian army, and that was really they were defending the eastern part of Warsaw, and many, many of them died. And then there was a regiment, cavalry regiment, that the head of it was a Jewish colonel, was called Berek Yoselewicz, Beru. And Yoselewicz means that he was the son of Yosel. All right? Because you see the names, again, I just to go on a tangent, the names were given only in the last century, in the beginning, maybe, or the end of the 18th century. So anybody before was Beru, the son, you know, of Yosu, and so on and so on. And the Polish names were also Simon from this and this village, or Simon the Hunchback, or Simon this, or Simon that. Later on, they started giving last names, okay? So you had last names instead of the son of, the names that ended in ICZ, Polish names. Joselewicz, Adamkiewicz for Poles, let's say. That means the son of Joshua, the son of Adam. Then there were names given from trades. Like you have in English, you have a tailor and goldsmith or whatever. Or in German, goldsmith, let's say. They were given from trades. Or the names were given from towns, villages, whatever. So you had the Warszawski, which means from Warsaw. All right? And then maybe you remember there was a big labor leader, Potocki. He was here in the States, Jakub Potocki. I think he was a garment worker or something. Big shot in New York. And Potocki is a Count Potocki in Poland. But, you know, they lived on his villages or whatever. So that's how the names came. So we had that kernel. And then they fought in every uprising, the Jews fought. And they were very, very, very patriotic. And there is a famous picture and story that in 1863, when there was a demonstration in Warsaw against the Russian soldiers. The Cossacks were shooting at the demonstrations, and they killed the priest who carried a cross. And a Jewish rabbinical student picked up the cross and carried it instead of the priest. You know, so this kind of thing. In the first officer of the Polish Legion in the First World War, the Piłsudski's legions, Piłsudski was... I guess the Polish George Washington, you can say, or something. The first officer killed in a battle with the Russians was a Jewish lieutenant who is buried in the Warsaw Cemetery, Jewish cemetery. So you see, there wasn't anti-Semitism, sure, in the country especially. The peasants were hungry, so the priests were telling them, well, it's because the Jews are taking everything. Or the gentry who owned land and so on, they wanted to get taxes or whatever from the peasants, so they opened inns, and then they were telling that it was the Jews who were selling vodka. All right, and I read an article. It was sent to me from Poland, Polish newspaper. There is a priest who is very active in Jewish-Catholic relations or Polish relations. And he attended a meeting in Krakow, in the city of Krakow, a few months ago, last year, of the group which is very much interested in working out things between the two societies. And the head of the group is a gentleman by the name of Potocki, obviously related to the family. And when someone from the audience stood up and said, well, but the Jews used to sell vodka to the peasants, that gentleman, Potocki, got up and said, it's not the Jews, my ancestors. So you see, this is kind of a thing. It's kind of a hate-love relationship, kind of.
Would you say, Dr. Bork, that it gives you pleasure that one of your children has adopted a Jewish way of life?
That's her business. It doesn't make any difference to me. That's her. I'm passive about it. She's a grown-up person, and she can do whatever she wants to. Her first husband, as I told you, was of Italian extraction. Didn't bother me.
Could you describe Warsaw for us? It seems you were a good student. Did you win any awards in high school or?
I graduated with honors from high school.
And in university?
I didn't finish it in Poland. I finished my studies here. And I was a B student. Mm-hmm. Also got some honors here in some area.
You began by studying medicine, I think, did you not?
Pardon?
I say you...
Yeah, I started in Poland, yes, studying medicine.
Studying medicine.
That's right.
And then you changed over to pharmacy.
To pharmacy after coming to this country, yeah.
Was there a reason for that?
Yes, it was. I came in 1947, and of course that was the time when the American army was being demobilized, and there was the Bill of Rights, and the veterans had a priority. The universities were not prepared for veterans, they were not prepared for, and especially the medical schools. So they had priority, and I knew that I wouldn't have a chance to get in. But wanted to stay in the health service. And consequently, I selected pharmacy. And at that time, it was 4 years, I wanted to become independent as soon as I could, not to depend, you know, on my relatives and so on. It seemed like a logical choice. At that time, there were no male nurses. I couldn't go into nursing.
How did you then get your position on the faculty of Duquesne?
Well, I went after I graduated. I went to a national pharmaceutical meeting, and that's where people found jobs. And I met a colleague from the graduate school who was a dean at Duquesne at that time, dean of pharmacy. And I just asked him point blank, John, do you have a job by any chance? I'm looking for a position. And he says, well, I'll know this evening. Let's have breakfast together tomorrow. I said, fine. So by that time, he knew that he had a position.
Wonderful.
And that's how I came.
Besides having an inclination for medicine and for pharmacy, did you have any desire to study other sciences, physics?
No, not really. No, I wanted. I didn't feel that physics or anything like that would give me the independence that I was seeking. You know.
You were interested primarily in the field of medicine.
Well, yes, because of my father. But also, I was interested in physics and so on, but, you know, at that time, physics didn't bring bread and butter.
And, of course, in later years, did you get into the field of nuclear medicine?
Yeah, nuclear medicine, nuclear pharmacy, especially. Mm-hmm.
They used to say that professors at university, quote, publish or perish. Did you do any writing for publishing?
Yes, I did. I published several papers. But Duquesne was at that time not a publish or perish university. They were, and still are, primarily a teaching university, although there is a lot of research going on now. But at that time, it was teaching and relationship with students. Every time, let's say, when I started writing grants for that area of nuclear pharmacy, every time I got a grant either from the Atomic Energy Commission or from the National Science Foundation, Father McEnroe, the chancellor, the president of that, would send me a personal letter thanking me. You know, so it was very, very, very family-like.
Pleasant.
Very pleasant, definitely.
Was there any one friend or teacher that suggested to you what course of study you should take? Or did you...
No, I just...
Because of your father's...
Because of the father, and also here because there was my uncle in America. His niece's husband, I think, or something, had a pharmacy in Chicago, and yeah, they were doing all right. He was independent. So I figured out that that would be, you know, the closest to medicine, and at the same time making me an earner.
Yes.
Rather rapidly.
When you were raising your children, did you vacation with them when they were young?
Oh, yes. Sure. Mm-hmm.
And whereabouts did you vacation? At the
shore? Well, we used to go visit the grandparents who lived in Manhattan, my former wife's parents. So we used to go to New York, and, you know, we took in the theater, and the kids were with the grandparents, or we took the kids to the playground in Central Park, you know, to the zoo on Fifth Avenue there, entrance. And but we didn't go to the shore, no.
Was reading a part of your children's?
Yes, yes.
Part of children's habits.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they like to read, and you know, at that time, the television about just started, and I remember that we were opposed to it. But pretty soon we discovered, and we lived in Chicago, that was with the older one, we pretty soon discovered that we couldn't get a babysitter because we didn't have a TV set. So we got a TV set, a black and white Motorola. But again, the programs for children were cartoons and this, and they usually watched it Saturday morning when we wanted to sleep a little longer. Or Sunday morning.
Are you currently involved, Dr. Bork, in Jewish or community institutions or affairs?
I sent my contribution to the UJF, but that's about it, really. If someone wants to interview me, fine. But not really. Sometimes I go. Oh, now they will have the Emmerman series of the Rod of Shalom. Well, I'll probably go because I knew Frieda Silverman and I knew him. So, but you know the all the anniversaries and this. No. Mm-mm.
What? How do you? Can you contrast in any way the way that you were raised as a young person with the way that you raised your children? Was there more permissiveness when you raised your children as opposed to the way in which you were brought up?
Yes, there was more permissiveness, but, you know, that doesn't mean that there were no limits. In other words, I wanted to be a physician, well, because my father was a surgeon, and he was going to train me how to be a good surgeon. Well, we didn't influence our daughters like that. They were free to choose. And my ex-wife is professional. She's a psychologist. And we didn't influence them either to go into psychology or to go into pharmacy. They selected the schools and the area. And, you know, it was okay with us.
Well, do you feel that your accomplishments,
yeah,
and your successes, are you happy with what you've done through these years now that you're retired and look back at it?
Yes, I'm very happy, and if I were to start it all over again, I would do it the same way. Mm-hmm.
What do you consider to be your greatest accomplishment?
Well, achieving the position that I achieved in this country, you know, coming as not as a youngster. This is one thing. And the other thing that gives me a lot of satisfaction is helping other young people. For example, and in 1977, when I was in Poland, I met a woman who was in her, she was 30 around that time, had two master's degrees, one in English and one in philosophy. Graduated from the Jagiellonian University, which is a very good university in Poland, and she looked like a bright person, you know, we talked. And I asked her if she would like to come and get a PhD here. Well, at that time I knew the dean of the graduate school at Duquesne and so on. To make a long story short, she came. She got into the school. She finished her PhD. She stayed with me for 2 years. And then I kind of married her off, so to speak. Not like Jente, the matchmaker, but there was a colleague she had, and he was interested in it. It's very fine, so she remained. All right, this is kind of a person that in Poland she would never get a job because she was not a go-getter. Any job that she taught English in the theater school in Krakow, very good one, but her aunt had to get her the job. All right, so that was one thing. Then In 1991, quite by chance, I met a 16-year-old who came here under the exchange program, high school exchange program. And a friend of her parents stayed with me over the summer. He taught Polish at Pitt over the summer. And, you know, they called up that the girl was coming here and under the exchange program, and she selected a big city, so they sent her to Altoona. And she's from Łódź, which is a large city. And the planes didn't meet. You know, there's probably one plane that flies to Altoona and back. Well, she had to stay overnight, and that friend of mine asked me if it would be all right if she stayed in the house. Sure. So he picked her up and brought her over, and I talked with her a little bit, and again I saw that was a bright kid. So after a half year in Altoona, where she didn't have any friends except whom she met on the bus to school and back, because she lived on a farm, they asked me if I would find a family for her here, American family. I couldn't find any American families, you know, for a teenager. And Polish families were not interested either. And so I told them that I have a house, and she would have a separate room, and so on and so on. And at that time there was the business with the Kennedy Smith in Florida, and I told him that I'm not a Kennedy, and I'm not a professional rapist. And, yeah, just, you know, point blank. And they sent her to me. And she was they arranged everything with Taylor Alder, there was no problem. And she was a very bright child, very pleasant, you know, a class. So she did 2 years in 1 year, 2 years of high school in 1 year at Alder. So then I told her, you know what, and I... She, you know, she didn't pay for food or anything. There's room, for God's sakes. When she finished Alder Dice, I said to her, listen, if you get into a university in this city, and if you find at least a partial scholarship, because for foreign students there are no monies. So I said, I'll help you out with the interest-free loan. If your parents agree, you can stay. So they agreed. Very smart people. And she was bright. She got into Duquesne, and not because I worked there. She just made an impression. Went into business school, took this most difficult major that they had in business school, and finished Duquesne in 3 years. And the last year she had a full scholarship. So All right, so then she graduated, got married, continues, just finished her last course for an MBA. All right. She has a very high position with Baxter International in Chicago, so she travels. They live in Indiana because he has a position, good position in Indiana. So she travels at least once a week to Chicago, gets up in the middle of the night. All right, well, a person like that, it's worth helping. But what on top of everything happened, she had a younger sister. And the younger sister came here for a visit several years ago. A very pleasant kid also. But within 2 years, both of their parents died. All right?